Welcome to WMNF 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. This is the Tuesday Cafe. I'm Sean Canaan, and it is Giving Tuesday. Happy Giving Tuesday from all of us at WMNF. We know every nonprofit is asking you for your support. WMNF is a charity that gives a voice to so many great causes. Our goal today is $8,000. Please keep our voice broadcasting loud and clear by donating to WMNF.org or by calling 813-238-8001. Thank you so much. Well, we have a special show lined up today. In the second half of this show, there will be a chance for you to meet WMNF's new senior reporter, Arielle Stevenson. You might remember her work in the WMNF newsroom and her music show, Artful Dodgings. So that's coming up later in the show. I hope you stay tuned. We're going to take your calls at 813-239-9663. You can also email DJ at WMNF.org. You can also text us at 813-433-0885. First up today is our guest is a filmmaker and the founder of the group Cultural Innovations in Action. Jan Roberts did a six-week road trip around the country to find solutions for racial inequity. Welcome to WMNF's Tuesday Cafe, Jan.
Thank you.
Oh, let me turn your mic on. What is it that made you consider a cross-country road trip and a documentary about racial inequity?
Well, I've been a community organizer and a grassroots organizer for close to 50 years. And in the last 25 years, I've been most interested in the new economy, which is restructuring the economy so it takes care of people and the planet before profit. And I did do a road trip in 2014, videotaping groundbreakers that were really doing that. And then with the pandemic and just the Black Lives Matter and the growing horror of the racial wealth inequity of Native Americans and Blacks, I thought I'd really like to go out there and look at those solutions. So I did a six-week trip, 15,000 miles, and interviewed 25 groundbreakers. I had a camera person with me this time that made the technology stuff a lot easier.
That was in 2014, or are you talking about a more recent one?
I just got back October the 11th from the six-week trip. In the 2014, I was by myself in my Prius with my video camera for 2 months.
So we're going to talk in this half hour or so about some of the solutions that you've seen that are working in other places in the country. For example, some cities and states are handing out cash reparations. Now, reparations has a kind of a loaded word. Some people get really, really upset when they hear the word reparations. But you've found places where it's worked. So Where is cash reparations working?
Yeah, the cash reparations is a slower solution than others, but the big thing that I think most people are hearing about are cash reparations for descendants of slavery. This was cash reparations being done by the city of Evanston because of the discrimination that prevented Blacks from owning homes in that city. And an alderman, Robin Rue Simmons, took the lead in doing that, brought together people from all across the community, stakeholders, ordinary folks. And the city said, we want our history. We want to know what this was. So a city historian put a face on the discrimination from some of the federal policies, et cetera. And she won. They all persuaded the city council to issue cash reparations for Black home ownership, which is $10 million over a 10-year period, $1 million a year, that comes out of the revenue from recreational marijuana. And that then goes $25,000 for into home ownership, a home down payment or whatever for Black residents in the city. First and only one in the nation, and she's getting a lot of calls for help.
And that's the city of Evanston, Illinois. How large of a city is that? Because if you're talking about $1 million spread over about how many people?
I don't know those details. I wish I had looked that up. But
it's not a gigantic city. It's not a big metropolitan area like Tampa Bay.
It's right. It's really right close to Chicago. It's several. Somebody Google it and call in because I'd like to know. But it is a good-sized city.
So how is it? I mean, for a lot of people might might understand this question before I even ask it, but how is it that historically there was the ability for a city to, or banks, or whoever's in charge of it, to stop Black potential homeowners from buying homes?
It came from all levels. It came from the neighborhood levels where deed restrictions and racial covenants prevented Blacks from living in those neighborhoods that had white homeownership, which had the better schools and the better roads, et cetera, all the way up to the national government with the Federal Housing Association. They came out with redlining, which meant that mortgage loans that they were doing that were very low interest, they redlined, prevented Black communities from receiving those mortgages. And that, of course, created, because so much of our wealth equity is in home ownership and passing it down through generations. So that's been a big player in the racial wealth inequity for generations.
How well is this program working? Did it just start?
It just launched this last year. I think they have 10 people that they have, I don't know what all the criteria are, but that are being helped now with owning homes. But it all came from a woman who's lived there all her life and had grown up and seen the difference in the neighborhoods. And they have 45% of Blacks own homes in that city, while 74% of whites do. So that was the inequity they were addressing.
Our guest is Jan Roberts. She is the founder of the group Cultural Innovations in Action. She's also a filmmaker who did a 6-week road trip around the country to find solutions for racial inequity. We've already talked about one of the cities she visited, Evanston, Illinois, where the city is handing out cash reparations to Black homeowners, potential homeowners, in order to get them into homes and to kind of right a historic wrong that has happened there in the city and elsewhere, of course. And this is Tuesday Cafe with Sean Canaan. It's 10:13 in the morning on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. So thanks so much for listening. Well, Jan, let's talk next about the state of Missouri, where the Office of the Public Defenders made a big change. So what was the change that happened in the state of Missouri Office of Public Defenders?
That's huge. And it all is because of Steve Hanlon, who was an attorney here for many years with Holland Knight. He started their public interest arm and he took that to Washington, D.C., and then he retired in St. Louis, Missouri. And what he did was he got a big, well-respected accounting firm to do a statistical analysis between the time spent by private attorneys on every task of a case compared to time spent by a public defender on the same kind of case. And what they found, public defenders were getting maybe an hour for every 12 hours that private attorneys were doing. So he took that a step further and proved that because of that, clients were not getting equal representation in the courts of public defenders as they were by private attorneys. And that got challenged all the way up to the Supreme Court level in Missouri, and it's in place. And I interviewed Steve, and I also interviewed the woman, Mary Fox, who's heading up the office, the Missouri State Office of Public Defenders. And they're in a process of a 5-year transition where clients of public defenders and she said 87% of 80% of cases that come to public defenders are either mental health or addiction cases. And so now they're doing major felonies, and these others are being referred for mental health treatments, et cetera. And as a result, the public defender office across the state has no waiting lists in Missouri. So it's really a way to a remedy for mass incarceration by equal representation in the courtroom.
So there have been a couple of different positive outcomes in this Missouri example. First of all, it reduces the workload on the public defenders, who are historically overworked in just about any jurisdiction. But it also gives people who have just done maybe potentially misdemeanors, it gives them other opportunities to, rather than just going to court and getting cases handled by attorneys, they can do alternatives. So it gives them really a more of a chance to get back into society and not be caught up in the jail system.
Yes. And it's hardly endorsed by the Office of Public Defenders in Missouri. In fact, she's writing grants for some restorative justice programs there.
And I want to thank one of our listeners, Robert, who wrote in to say Evanston is 12 miles north of downtown Chicago in the same county of Cook. Its current population is 78,000. So it's part of a giant metropolis, but the boundaries that we're talking about where these reparations are occurring, 78,000, so that makes it, you know, kind of a smallish city mm-hmm. compared to ones we're used to, Tampa, St. Pete.
Thank you, Robert. Lakeland.
Yeah, thanks very much. It's hard to Google when you're hosting a talk show, so I appreciate our listeners' help. I just want to remind people that our guest is Jan Roberts. She is a filmmaker and the founder of the group Cultural Innovations in Action. She did a 6-week road trip around the country to find solutions for racial inequity, and she came across some communities who have done some creative things, and these solutions are working. One example is worker-owned cooperatives. Mm. For example, what did you find in Cleveland of worker-owned cooperatives?
Cleveland is actually the model for commercial-sized worker-owned cooperatives. When I say commercial size, there's a lot of mom and pop owned worker-owned cooperatives that, you know, they're smaller. What they're doing there is they did research and with anchor institutions like Case Western Reserve University, University Hospital, Cleveland Clinic, on the monies they were spending on services and commodities outside the community. So first of all, the anchor institutions allowed them to do a deep dive into their finances to look at that, and Democracy Collaborative, a research nonprofit, took the lead in it, and it was astounding to everybody involved, the multiple billions of dollars that was being spent outside the community. So the community foundation there was the convener of the anchors and the mayor and others in the city together to come up with a plan for establishing these worker-owned cooperatives. And now they have a commercial worker-owned laundry. They're all called Evergreen Cooperatives. The laundry has 300 worker owners, and the worker owners are guaranteed, this can never change, 80 to 90% of the profit goes to the worker owners. And they have education benefits, they have health care, they have home ownership through low-cost loans for homes. It's really a beautiful model. And that, they also have a Green Growers, which is the largest urban Green Growers hydroponic. They have like 3 million heads of lettuce they sell. And the anchors have stayed with it. That was what was most important. They had to make a 10-year commitment to stay with this and make it happen. And they did. And now what they're doing there is they have started a fund for employee ownership. And what that means is Evergreen Cooperatives goes out and acquires private businesses that are being, where the owner may be retiring, he just or she doesn't want to do it anymore, and they convert it into worker-owned. And they're finding that productivity rates go up, they expand. So that's another wonderful model, and it doesn't require so much work, basically, to convert to worker-owned as it does to establish a brand new one. So it's a beautiful program.
And I want to remind people that if you are interested in learning more about worker-owned cooperatives, this is a topic that comes up quite often on Richard Wolff's Economic Update, and that show airs at 10:04 on Friday, every Friday morning here on WMNF, so you can learn more about worker cooperatives there. So speaking of worker cooperatives, Jan, in Jackson, Mississippi, yes, there's a very specific type that you came across that's been very successful. What can you tell us about what's happening in Jackson?
The whole way this happened or is happening in Jackson, Mississippi, it came from the ground up. It's called Cooperation Jackson, and it actually started in the 1980s out of the Black Liberation Movement. The African Voices Organization, I think, made a visit to Mondragon in Basque, Spain. Mondragon is the model for these worker-owned cooperatives in Cleveland and in Jackson. It started during the Franco years and the war. And a priest started it in 1950s, cooperative education, and that then led to social groups and a baseball team. Now it's workaround cooperatives, 151 firms. They put a certain percentage, as does the Cleveland, into an incubator fund for more workaround cooperatives. Well, when the people with the African Voices organization got back to Jackson, Mississippi, after seeing what came out of the war in Basque, Spain, and they looked around and they said, you know, we have the same backdrop here as they did in Basque, Spain, from the Civil War and what's been going forward ever since then. And so they said, let's organize like the people in Mondragon did. And so they have formed Cooperation Jackson, which is 100 members, and each member comes with from a different organization, a social organization, a labor organization. And that network is now establishing community land trusts for home ownership. They have done the community, Community Production Center is a lightweight manufacturing center, and now they are producing N95 3D printing, N95 masks, and hand-sewn masks, and they're financially sustainable. And they now are going to be 3D printing housing, and they're going to do a conference in 2022. They're going to offer a yurt, a loft, a traditional house. And this is like a hard-scrabble, ground-up workaround cooperative network that is really bursting forward in Jackson, Mississippi.
And I haven't spent much time in Jackson, Mississippi, but I imagine that the people who would be forming these Cooperation Jackson, these cooperatives, there's not a lot of wealth in the black community No. in Jackson after the Civil War, is my understanding. So, but this is helping people come out of racial inequity and into more equal terms.
Yeah, I think a big deal in this new economy or democratic economy or regenerative economy, whatever you want to call it, is changing the business ownership, redesigning business ownership. So, and that's what these workaround cooperatives do.
I want to remind people that our guest is Jan Roberts. She's a filmmaker and the founder of the group Cultural Innovations in Action. We're talking about a six-week road trip around the country that she did to find solutions for racial inequity. You're listening to Tuesday Cafe with Sean Canaan on 88.5 FM on WMNF.org. Right now, I want to switch gears to where, when you visited Los Angeles, there was a city-owned bank. So what can you tell about we'll back up a bit. How does the banking industry magnify racial inequities? And then what happened in Los Angeles to improve that?
Oh, just the loans alone. Credit allocation loans to blacks and minorities is not... There's big discrimination in how that is done by the banking industry. And also, as I heard in L.A., one out of... four people have a hard time even getting an account because of the banking fees and stuff like that. And I found that same thing on reservations. So the public banking, and that's how they see it. I will tell you that the public banking movement, when I was 2014, I interviewed Ellen Brown, who is founder of the Public Banking Institute. She's still there. She was running for Secretary of Treasury for California. She got over 200,000 votes. That sort of spawned an interest in this, but the organizing force for the public bank in L.A. was the divestment movement. There was a big movement to divest funds from Wells Fargo was the big bank that was getting the city funds and putting it into fossil fuel industry. So those organizers that came together for that were sort of the kernel for what happened in L.A. And by the way, Bill McGibbon, who's the environmentalist and founder of 350.org, He says $40 trillion has been divested from the fossil industry since this movement started in 2012, which is a lot of money. Anyway, so that was the beginning of the organizing. Do you want me to talk more about that organizing?
Yeah, I'd like to know about the success rate. How has it changed people's lives to have these city-owned banks in Los Angeles?
You are ahead of what's happening here, Sean. What's happening now is this is a big deal that they're going to establish a public bank in LA, the mm-hmm. first municipal-owned bank. And it took them, a few years to get here. They had to get a state bill passed that allowed that put forward guidelines for public banks, and then they had to organize for that. And they had big lobbyists. They had 9 lobbying firms fighting them at the state level for that. And they formed 100 organizers who dropped in and made appointments with legislators to get that passed. Then there was an alliance of 10 banks formed in the state of California to establish public banks. LA is the one that's furthest ahead. They have passed all the economics committees. They have passed the city council to do this in LA, and they've just sent out an RFP now for a business plan for establishing it. And when I asked Trinity Tran, who is the lead organizer for all of this, she said in 2 years they expect to have it up and running.
Oh, so good. So we'll keep an eye on how
keep
that
an
does.
Eye. And that's what I do want to make clear. This is a yes, Cleveland's established and Cooperation Jackson's coming along. And yes, we have a program for cash reparations for black home ownership. But this is stuff that is now coming to fruition that has been seeded for a long time.
I want to remind people that we're talking with Jan Roberts, a filmmaker and the founder of the group Cultural Innovation in Action. She did a 6-week road trip around the country to find solutions for racial inequity. It's 10:28 in the morning, and my name is Sean Canaan. I'm the host of Tuesday Cafe on WMNF Tampa, WMNF.org. You alluded to it briefly a moment ago, Jan, but you have visited Native American reservations.
Yes.
And to find out the ways they're dealing with racial inequity. So what are the efforts to reclaim their culture, language, and tribal wealth on two of the reservations you visited were the Pine Ridge and the Rosebud Sioux reservations?
Yeah, and those are both in South Dakota. I think it's important. My first interview was with an indigenous economist, Rebecca Adamson, who has been working at this for many, many years. I've been fortunate enough to know her since the 1990s. And their whole, the indigenous people's idea of wealth is different from our Western view. It isn't about money. It isn't about home ownership. It's about having enough for everybody and taking care of the land. They are so close to their land. So reclaiming their language, reclaiming their ways of living, reclaiming their culture, their spirituality is wealth to them. And as a result of that, we have on the Pine Ridge Reservation a 34-acre regenerative homes that are being built there, net zero, which I love about the fact that indigenous people, because they're so connected to the land, care so much about the planet. And those homes, they have completed 21 homes there. But a bigger thing that's happening there is the food sovereignty, the Lakota language immersion schools, and the food sovereignty. Pine Ridge Reservation is in the poorest county in the whole country in South Dakota. And in order to get fresh produce and fresh meats, they have to drive, I think it took me 2 hours into Rapid City back and forth just to get that kind of thing. So they've established a food sovereignty coalition where they are building, they're helping elders right now, but they're spreading that into having private gardens. They're going to expand that. They've got college extension courses working with them. The Paul Newman Foundation has funded chickens and demonstration farm and wind high tunnels. Those, they're like, glass houses, but they're like, they're protected from the wind. What are they called?
I don't.
Robert, look it up. Anyway, it's indoor gardening. It can take place.
Like a greenhouse?
Yes, thank you. Yes, a greenhouse. So they have those now on the reservation. And I think I have to tell you the story of Sage Fast Dog on the Rosebud Sioux Reservation, because he was so beautiful in talking about, he's started a Lakota language immersion school there for 4 to 6 year olds, where they don't hear any English. Everything is Lakota language from the time they walk in. And when he talks about reclaiming his language, he talks about how meaningful it is to him and to the Lakota people to be connected to their ancestors through that language. That is the basis of their culture. That is the basis of their spirituality. And one of the most moving moments was when he sang me a Lakota song and translated it into English. And it was after the boarding school era, that they separated children from families and forced people to give up their kids to put them in boarding schools to eradicate the Indian culture. And make them, as Sage Dog said, it was just silly for them to think we'd become Caucasian Europeans by them doing this. But he sang the song about reclaiming his long hair, reclaiming his language. It was very, very moving. And now they're doing language immersion for adults, and they're paying adults to come to do this. It's part of, they think, the wealth of the whole community to have adults and children speaking and being connected to their language.
And so those are Native American reservations in South Carolina. I have a
South Dakota.
I'm sorry, you're right, South Dakota. And I have a texter calling in or sending a message from the 863 area code, says, I think North Dakota has state banks. Now I don't know if you traveled there, is that right?
Yes, North Dakota has the one and only state-owned bank. It's been around for 100 years. It's the flagship for the whole public banking movement. That bank didn't have one foreclosure during the 2008 crisis. They have had a wonderful student loan program, but then the federal government came in, so that kind of went by the wayside. But they partner with local banks in order to do low interest loans for what the community needs, whether it's affordable housing, et cetera. And they haven't had one default. It's just an incredible model.
Our guest is Jan Roberts, a filmmaker and the founder of the group Cultural Innovations in Action. She did a 6-week road trip around the country to find solutions for racial inequity. You're listening to WMNF Tampa. This is the Tuesday Cafe. I'm Sean Canaan. So Jan, people right now might be thinking, well, these are some really good ideas that seem to be working in a lot of areas around the United States. This or that of these ideas I might like to try here in the Tampa Bay community. What advice would you give someone who is thinking about maybe trying to incorporate some of these ideas into their own community?
Well, there is something happening here in Tampa. I do think Tampa is waking up. I'd like to see more workaround stuff going on, and I'm happy to talk to anybody about how to get that started. One of the commitments I got from everybody I talked to, including the CEO of the Cleveland Workaround Cooperatives, the vice president from the community foundation there, was they are happy to come to Tampa. They're happy to do, because I was always asking the same question. And I will tell you, there is stuff happening here. I just, 83 Degrees, an online communication newspaper, they just had a report that the county has approved $750,000, I think, startup funds for community land trusts. And so that they're getting that going here. That was big in Durham and in other places. And Hillsborough County also, and this happened in Cleveland as well, also just recognized racism as a public health problem, so a public health issue. So, and that's exactly what Cleveland did. And the vice president of the community foundation up there, they sent 10,000 people, the foundation did, for racial equity training in Greensboro, North Carolina. And they have a five-year plan that they've been engaged with in order to look at root causes and change things. And she is very happy about what's happening in Cleveland. And she's going to be talking to a small group of people here. I'm connecting her on Zoom later in the month, December, with a small group of folks here in Tampa who are working on racial equity. So there are some things bubbling up, and I'm happy if anybody's interested, they can email me. Is it okay if I say that?
Give out your email, sure.
jroberts@ciaction.org, and I'm happy to connect you in any way I can.
And that's J, the initial J, then Roberts.
Yes.
At ciaction.org.
Uh-huh.
And so people can contact you if they want to help connect with you to get people working on these solutions here in Tampa. So, and Tampa, the Tampa Bay area, that is. So where can people find out more about your group, Cultural Innovations in Action?
Well, we have a website, ciaction.org. And we have... I'm working on transcribing the footage from all of this. We had 25 folks and a lot of B-roll. So that's all being transcribed. And then I'm doing fundraising in order to get professional editing. So can I say what the end product is that I'd like to have?
Yeah, what would you like?
I'd like to have a 60-minute documentary with highlights from some of these interviews. By the way, every time I asked anybody anything, I did a longer form interview where steps, how to make this happen in your town. And so then I want to do a docu-series that brings together some of these programs that just are a natural fit and get all that out there. So I have big plans. I really feel like now is the time. There's such an interest. I really do think this is going to be happening.
Well, Jan, thanks so much for coming on WMNF. I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you.
Jan Roberts is a filmmaker and the founder of the group Cultural Innovations in Action. She did a 6-week road trip around the country to find solutions for racial inequity. We're going to take a short music break right now. And then after that, we're going to bring in our next guest, and that's WMNF's new senior reporter, Ariel Stevenson. So I hope you stay tuned to meet Ariel. You're listening to Tuesday Cafe with Sean Canaan on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. Stay with us. Snail Mail from her new album. This song is called Madonna. You're listening to WMNF's Tuesday Cafe with Sean Canaan. You may have heard that WMNF has hired a new senior reporter, and it's a name that will be familiar to longtime listeners of WMNF. It's Ariel Stevenson. She's joining me in the studio right now so we can introduce her to the community. Welcome back to the WMNF airwaves, Ariel.
Oh, thank you so much. It's good to be back here. It's good to be on this microphone again.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. And you're going to be reporting stories for us, as well as anchoring most of the morning news headline newscasts. So I want to let people know a little bit of the background. How old were you when you got started here at WMNF?
I was 15 technically my first day, but the next day was my 16th birthday, and so when I officially started here, I was 16. Couldn't drive here yet. Had to bum rides from Largo to Tampa, and as soon as I got my license, you saw me. I was in here as often as they'd let me be, and I always got to co-anchor the Friday evening newscast when we had the hour-long newscast. So it's been a long, weird ride, but it's been good.
Yeah, and so do you remember any of the stories that you would have been covering back when you were 16 years old?
I remember my first story with Andrew Stelzer. One of the first days I had here at MNF, we went chasing Catherine Harris, the Bush cousin from the Hanging Chad debacle. She was stumping for school vouchers at a public school, and all these reporters gathered outside and all these angry parents. That was like my first week, I think. But got to cover a lot of really cool protest actions, a lot of really interesting news stories across the entire area, and it exposed me to a whole world that I had no idea about, and the journalism bug bit, and it never stopped.
And you went from there, your full-time job would have been at Creative Loafing. One of the things you did there is you ended up being the food editor at Creative Loafing for a while, but you had a different approach to food editing, to food articles, rather than just almost as, you know, plugging certain businesses.
Right.
What was it like?
Yeah, so I was a food editor and staff writer for Creative Loafing for a couple years. And in that position, I had a pretty big section I got to play around with. So I delegated, you know, like the food review kind of stuff to a proper food reviewer, because as much as I love to eat, that's not my expertise. And I really tried to focus on highlighting people who made food in the community that probably would never have been heard of otherwise if I hadn't written about them. These were places that were definitely word of mouth. I remember a really cool soul food restaurant that I'm not sure is still around in West Tampa. A lot of the like old school Vietnamese eateries over in Pinellas Park. So I really tried to focus my coverage on the stories of the people that were making the food, and you know, do as much news coverage as possible through that lens. And then I also got to cover the RNC for Creative Loafing, which was a wild ride in Tampa in 2012. I also got to cover a lot of election coverage during that time, abortion legislation. So it was a really great opportunity to cover a wide variety of topics. And I worked under Mitch Perry there, as I worked under Mitch Perry here back when I first started. So it was a really incredible place to get my writing down.
You're listening to WMNF's Tuesday Cafe. I'm Sean Canaan, and my guest is our new senior reporter, Ariel Stevenson. We're kind of introducing, or maybe reintroducing, her to the WMNF community. You also have been a stringer, like a freelancer for the New York Times for several years. What's that been like, writing for the New York Times and seeing your stories in print for the Times?
It was surreal. It really was surreal. I never expected an opportunity like that to come along. And I actually started freelancing for them in 2012 as a result of the RNC. They randomly contacted me and they wanted a food story about Tampa that wasn't well known. You know, to people who aren't from here, we may be known for maybe Cuban sandwiches or steakhouses or, you know, fried shrimp baskets. But, you know, I focused on the Cuban Chinese food at Arco Iris. Like, there's an interesting story there. And then from there, in 2014, end of 2013, I started stringing for the New York Times. And basically, I cover all of Central Florida for them. And so when any news breaks, which Florida is notorious for news breaking pretty often, they would send me out and I would go hunt down interviews and information for other reporters to use for their reporting. But often those reporters would be out of the country and I would get to work on some really interesting stories. One of the first big stories I worked on was the Cobb Theater shooting, where the former police officer, former security officer had shot a veteran in the Cobb Theater. And it was
in Pasco County?
In Pasco County, yeah. It was a pretty interesting case. And at the time, they were just at the start of that whole story. And it was basically like a mini trial, and it was just to determine bond. And so that was one of my first big breaks for the Times, and it was a heck of a ride to get to cover, and a really strange, interesting story in terms of Stand Your Ground coming into the fold just to determine bond. So that was one of the first bigger stories I got to do for them. And that was because another correspondent happened to be in the Caribbean. So, you know, Florida's a really great place, I always say, to be a journalist, because, you know, everything, all the roads lead here somehow.
And Florida man.
Florida man who's, you know, I always argue that Florida man's usually from somewhere else.
Good point.
I think our public records laws have more to do with why big stories come out of this place. We just have the best public records laws. You can find out just about anything. And then from there, the next big story I kind of worked on was about Cuban-American relations and kind of the delineations between the Miami Cuban community and the Tampa Cuban community and their attitudes towards the Cuban Revolution. So that was really interesting work. I've really enjoyed the wide spectrum of stuff I've got to cover for them, from crime to culture. It's really, really been a rewarding journey, and it takes me all over the state, from like Beverly Hills, Florida to, you know, Boca Raton, and somehow that's all still considered Central Florida. You know, Daytona Beach is still considered Central Florida. I end up in Orlando a lot. But it's been really, really rewarding kind of work to get to do. Even if it doesn't always have my name at the top of the story, I like getting to see what reporters do with the work I send them as well.
Our guest is Ariel Stevenson. She's WMNF's new senior reporter. I'm Sean Canaan. I'm the host of WMNF's Tuesday Cafe. It's on every Tuesday at 10:06. And coming up next, we have Janelle Irwin with The Scoop. That's coming up at 11:06. But right now we're speaking with Ariel, and you haven't, your work lately hasn't just been in the news business. You also own a mobile record store.
Yeah.
Tell people about that.
Hello, Darlin' Records was kind of like a fever dream I came up with wanting to marry my love of vinyl with my love of Volkswagens, or my addictions rather, to those two things. So out of grad school, obviously work is kind of hard to find when you get right out of grad school. You're kind of like dazed and confused. And I had just finished up my master's degree at the Florida Studies program, and I'd been researching capital punishment history in the state of Florida pretty heavily. So I was looking for something light. And I was able to start my own business where I DJed vinyl out of my Volkswagen camper bus. And it's a 1972 camper bus. And eventually sold vinyl and did lots of huge events, the indie market when we were still on Baum Avenue, and, you know, got to play music, kind of taking from my experience here at MNF with, because I did music and news. I started in news, but I eventually had a music show, Artful Dodgings, which is a billion years ago now. But I really enjoyed getting to kind of be in I made like a mini radio station, essentially, with a very low bandwidth. And I really, really loved getting to do that again. And I loved getting to be on the mic again and play music for folks, and just the kind of impact that work has. So that was a lot of fun and a great challenge. An analog car and an analog musicality is certainly keeps you busy while you're working.
And your family has a musical history.
Yeah. Both my parents are jazz musicians, and some of my earliest memories, I think I wrote when I applied for the job, was at the old radio station. I would come on the Nick Lagos, Charles Vann Memorial Jazz Show on the Mother's Day special, because he would always bring his mom on, so my mom would always bring me along. And one of the funny instances of them being there was my dad's upright bass taking out a ceiling tile in the little house studio. So, and I remember seeing the tub in the bathroom, I remember was full of records. I just remember seeing a bathtub full of records and being like, okay, I'm home. This is where I want to be.
Well, how would you describe the music that you played on Artful Dodgings?
Well, the whole idea of the show, which I named while I was still a teenager, it was where the idea of genre is artfully dodged. And I kind of stand by that credo still, because I always want to play something at least once in a set list that hits everybody. You know, everyone's got lots of different tastes. Coming up here at the radio station, I got exposed to just so much music. The Friday night soul party after we would do the news, I mean, that music made such a huge impression on me, and I play a lot of that with Hello Darlin. But on Artful Dodgings, I was constantly vacillating between like current stuff I was listening to that was, you know, more indie-oriented, to straight-ahead jazz, to old Motown, to, you know, really weird deep cut reggae, because I grew up listening to the Caribbean Cruise. And so I really was pulling from a lot of places and trying to make a playlist that would satisfy as many people as possible, because I like people to feel as included as they possibly can. So like if the kid hears something they like, and the grandpa hears something they like, and the mom and dad hear something they like, you know, that's a success story in terms of playlist politics, as far as I'm concerned. So it's been a lot of fun. And yeah, like hearing Scott Elliott again the other day, my husband was like, okay, I see where you got all your stuff from. I was like, oh yeah, totally.
Wow. Quite a compliment. Well, Arielle Stevenson is our guest. She's WMNF's news senior reporter. You'll begin hearing her anchoring the morning news headlines this week and hear her news reports coming soon as well. You mentioned earlier your graduate degree in Florida Studies at USF St. Pete. What's Florida Studies?
It's a weird little program for folks that are just hot and bothered about the Sunshine State and can't help it. And, you know, we go all the way back in history. We do like Spanish paleography. And so I studied a lot of the like early indigenous cultures of the state all the way until current times. And we pull from literature, we pull from environmental science, and we pull from history. And so that's really where I got kind of my feet on the ground in terms of the kind of stories I wanted to tell. So I spent a lot of time working with Ray Arsenault on his most recent project, which was about Arthur Ashe. So that was a really incredible experience because I am not a sports person at all. So getting to learn like the history of tennis and specifically Arthur Ashe's impact was pretty incredible. But Florida Studies, I also got to study with, of course, Gary Mormino, who's like Mr. Florida as far as I'm concerned. My thesis focused on a capital punishment case from the 1960s where two black men were wrongfully accused of murder and sentenced to die. And they served 12 years on death row before basically it was proven beyond reasonable doubt that they hadn't done these crimes. And it was through the reporting at the Miami Herald of Gene Miller that really helped their case move along. And they were freed after 12 years on death row. So, you know, I definitely go into the light and the dark of the state of Florida. I try not to shy away from either. And that program was really vital into getting those skills. So really interesting stuff. I'm hopelessly in love with the state despite all of its flaws. So I'm excited to continue covering all of the stuff that comes along the pipeline with being a journalist here, as you know.
And part of your reporter training was a special program for young reporters. I believe it was in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
Is that right? What made you think about applying for that? And then what was that experience like?
Well, I wasn't even like officially a college student, but I applied to this program that was for college students, and I went to USF St. Pete and I basically told the journalism program like, hey, I'm going to do this. Are you guys, can you, you know, sponsor me basically? Can you vouch for me and say that I'll be a student here in the fall? And it was through The Nation and the Center for American Progress. And I got to spend 4 days with Jeremy Scahill, with Helen Thomas, Eric Schlosser from Fast Food Nation. I'm missing a few, but Jeremy Scahill made an incredible impression on me. And it wasn't like a huge conference, the journalism portion. It was like, you know, 30 people in a room for 4 days. So he definitely, I would say, you know, radicalized my reporting and the kind of work I wanted to do as a reporter and the kind of fearless kind of coverage that those reporters do. David Korn was there as well. And Helen Thomas, she was definitely like in full form, like spicy, you know. So I felt really honored to get to spend time with those individuals. And I also got to spend time with Free Speech Radio News in the Senate building with Leanne Caldwell. And we got to cover Mel Martinez doing immigration reform, or lack thereof, rather. And it was quite an experience. At that time, the Sami Alarian trial was also still going on, and that was in the mix pretty heavily up there, as it was still here, because that was one of the stories I covered for MNF in my early years, because that case went on forever. So it was, you know, priceless experience getting to spend time in the Capitol with those people, and obviously it kept me going for quite a long time, so...
And just a reminder to people, Free Speech Radio News, also called FSRN, is a show that used to be on the WMNF airwaves, and it was a half an hour national and international news story with kind of freelance reporters from all over the globe would contribute to this newscast. But part of it was really based in the WMNF newsroom, because we had at least two paid employees of FSRN were working here at WMNF. And the Leanne Caldwell, who you mentioned, was with FSRN. Now she's with NBC and right. MSNBC. You see her all the time on MSNBC or even on the Sunday morning talk shows.
Yeah,
she covers the Capitol. So I want to remind people that we're talking with Ariel Stevenson, who is WMNF's new senior reporter. You're listening to the Tuesday Cafe on WMNF Tampa. It's 10:57 in the morning. We just have a couple of minutes left. Jim wishes you a warm welcome via email, so thank you for that. Also, DeMarco here is talking about the Charles Van Show theme, and he gives us the music for it. So maybe try, if this works, maybe I'll go out with this music.
That's awesome.
And let's see. So, you know, recently you have been involved in reporting on some local issues in St. Petersburg, especially this banyan tree that was getting removed. What's going on with that?
Yeah, it was just kind of this beloved, kind of iconic banyan tree. And, you know, everyone was kind of stuck at home last summer to a certain extent, trying to navigate. You know, we had Black Lives Matter happening in St. Pete, where I was living at the time. You know, you would hear it every night. So I was trying to kind of use my voice for good, and we didn't end up saving the tree because of many reasons, one of which is a piece of law passed in Florida very recently, which doesn't matter if a tree is protected or not. If you can get an arborist to basically sign off on it, they can remove it. And there's a lot of controversy as to whether banyan trees should be allowed to grow at all. And, you know, they were brought here by Ford in hopes of a rubber substitute. It didn't work out, I guess. But they're super enchanting. So I got, you know, very caught up in this story of this tree and trying to save it. In the story I wrote, it kind of became like a banyan tree where it kept popping up and then growing down, and the cycles just kind of kept continuing, and trying to understand why this tree was so dangerous after it had been in this neighborhood for so many years. So it was a very hard story to cover, because Florida destruction is part of being a Floridian, is watching the place you're from get torn down, usually by people that just got here. So definitely made an impression on how I report on the environment moving forward. But, you know, it's something to consider as we move forward, just how precious our resources are and how hard it is to protect them.
But. And I've got a little bit of the music in the background.
Cool. Charles Van.
And we have about maybe 30 seconds left. If the last question I have is that you had a role in promoting the local craft beer scene for a bit there. just a short anecdote about that.
Oh, that was wild. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. I got to kind of flex and stretch my wings with some of the crazier ideas I have that journalism doesn't necessarily allow for. But I'm looking forward to being here and telling stories for y'all moving forward.
Well, Ariel Stevenson, thanks so much for coming on my show, and we'll hear more from you on the radio.
Oh yeah.
Our guest has been Ariel Stevenson, WMNF's new senior reporter, and I want to thank Lamar Robinson for answering our phones. You've been listening to Tuesday Cafe with Sean Canaan. The show is every Tuesday morning at 10. And just a reminder that it is Giving Tuesday. It's a day for you to support your favorite nonprofits. You can make a donation to WMNF at WMNF.org or by calling 813-238-8001. What we're listening to now is Caperange, which is translated to Jungle Soul by Bad Bossa Nova, Gene Ammons, that is. And it was sent to us by a listener as the theme song for the Charles Vann Memorial Jazz Show. Coming up next on WMNF is Janelle Irwin in her new time, 11 o'clock on Tuesday mornings with The Scoop. That's coming up after NPR News headlines. In this time slot tomorrow, Janet and Shelley will host Midpoint at 10 on WMNF Tampa. You're listening to WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland. Thanks so much for listening. Stay tuned for the NPR News headlines.